Blog Talk Radio.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. It's February 18th, 2023. Is Mayor Dickens a sellout? That is the question the Maroon Tiger College paper asks, and the public demands an answer. Did somebody just say, put your own damn pants on, Bill Cosby? Has the power structure of Atlanta's elite society able to hold the toxic ground below their feet? Or is Mayor Dickens just serving up more avocado toast for brunch? Did Mayor Dickens just say, my deck is stacked with all that? Does Mayor Dickens think this is really about five-card Monty? A few things we have on the mixtape tonight. We've got Nick Cave and the Bad Seed from the 1996 tour featuring Warren Ellis, another Bad Seed. Unicorn Riot reports on the wrongful conviction of Marvin Haynes, who spent 17 years in Stillwell Prison on a crime that he did not commit. We'll check in on Teen Vogue, says to Atlanta Mayor Dickens and the Atlanta Police Foundation, when it comes to Cop City, that dog won't hunt. Is there some kind of Pavlovian conditioning that's going on with Mayor Andre Dickens? Is Mayor Dickens able to take on the resurgence of the Defund the Police movement after the scheduled targeted assassination of Tortajita? Got a short clip about secret CIA biological warfare testing on the American population under the MKUltra program. We have Debbie Sharp, investigative reporter. This was from March 1981, where she talks about 149 sub-projects of the MKUltra program. This included spraying cadmium sulfide on unsuspected populations of brown, black, and poor people in 15 cities in the United States, including the Manitoba region of Canada and places inside the United Kingdom. And yes, ethnic weapons was a term used by the Army and the CIA in 1965. We have a short clip from the late Jeffrey Sinclair, where he mentions reporting on critical areas of public concern will get you fired, a caveat for investigative journalism. Got a short clip of Professor William Domhoff on his book, Who Rules America? This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. On the second half of the mixtape, we'll talk about lead contamination in Iowa, Kansas, Missouri, how 4,200 children in Missouri alone have elevated lead levels that will decrease their IQ at least 2.5%. As we've mentioned in other podcasts, that zinc cadmium sulfide is in the ground at the South Forest of Wahating. How it got there doesn't matter. What is there to do about it? What is in those ponds at Wahating? What is in the sediment? What is in the runoff? The Atlanta Police Foundation would say, hey, don't overload our apple cart. Don't spill the apple cart. Let's not forget the old school gun range, known as the Gulch, is full of lead contamination. from a half century of Atlanta police, Georgia police, federal police, polluting the ground with lead bullets. 38,000 tons of lead ammunition is manufactured every year. So not only do we have lead contamination from smelters, from spent industrial purposes, illegally dumped in Wahani, we have police firing tons and tons of lead in brown, black, and poor communities in America during the time of a lead epidemic. Half the people killed by police have some sort of mental distress. The school-to-prison nexus, no longer called school-to-prison pipeline, although SPP is still the acronym, the movement refers to it as school-to-prison nexus. The police have taken over public education just like the police have taken over city hall, county governments, state governments. This is an epidemic. 17,000 court jurisdictions, courts in parts of the United States that are mostly depopulating. Why are these rural areas depopulating? It's because they arrest poor people, they put them in prison, they dump them off in cities like St. Louis and Springfield, and they never return home. We got a short clip with William Luntz from the Committee for Doublespeak and how the power system can do an awful lot with language. We got a brief jab at Filthy Fred Koch, Charles and David Koch, corporate greed, bigotry, family values. We got heavy metal by Vixen Vendetta. We got death metal by Death Angel. We got loops by Nick Cave, Marianne Faithful. We put together a tribute to Tortajita to finish tonight's mixtape. Saturday Night Live sings about corporate control of media, the mediaopoly. It's been banned from the airwaves. You don't think there's censorship in America? Think again. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G.
Hey, let me just share this with you. I ain't never been no sellout. You got the wrong resume that you're looking at. I know we like to yell and shout out things just to be heard. You've been heard. But guess what? You picked the wrong resume to pull on a race car. You pulled the wrong one. My deck is stacked with all that. Let's go. So it's got to be met. So do you know that there's a fire? Nah. Hey, let me just share this with you. I ain't never been no sellout. You got the wrong resume that you're looking at. I know we like to yell and shout out things just to be heard. You've been heard. But guess what? You picked the wrong resume to pull on a race car. You pulled the wrong one. My deck is stacked with all that. So let's go. So it's got to be met.
This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. The 2020 uprisings for racial justice sparked many questions about the violence that police have brought on black and brown communities for generations. It also sparked on a nationwide level, via the slogan Defund the Police, the radical idea of abolishing police altogether. While many books have been written on the problems of policing to make a case for abolition, there are few that actually tackle what abolition could look like. One of them is a new work by my guest, Gio Maher. Gio Maher is a visiting associate professor at the Department of Political Science at Vassar College and senior research fellow at the Global Center for Advanced Studies. He's the author of 5 books, including We Created Chavez, Decolonizing Dialectics, Building the Commune, Spirals of Revolt, and now his latest book, which he joins me to discuss, A World Without Police, How Strong Communities Make Cops Obsolete. Welcome to the program, Gio.
I'm so glad to be here.
So let's first start with the fact that when we have had discussions around abolition, often it's seen as this radical idea. There is an underlying assumption built into our cultural fabric that of course we need cops. How could we even have a world without cops? Because otherwise we would have chaos, there would be no safety. Who would you call in case of an emergency? I imagine that that's a question that you often face.
Certainly. But we should also remember that, you know, the first wave of abolitionism, where abolition gets its name, in other words, the abolition of slavery, the same could have been said. Slavery was felt to be natural by the large segments of the American population. It was unquestioned by large segments of the South in particular. And it wasn't until a very compressed period around and before the Civil War that people began to shift their perspectives radically. And that's what we're talking about today, is really beginning to shift that perspective even more than it already has. And when you do so, you begin to denaturalize institutions like slavery and today like police and prisons. What that means is to begin to think differently, to think about what the world could or would look like without police, to think about what the conditions for a world without police would look like. Who would we call? Precisely that question of what your, you know, the structure of community would look like, what the relationship between us and our neighbors would look like. And we are unable fundamentally to think seriously about those questions in the world that we have, in a world that is structured around the police, in which police are seen as the solution to every social problem, the persons that you call when you have any kind of conflict, any kind of violence, suffer any kind of theft. These are questions that need to be asked, but it is primarily by beginning to ask them that we can begin to imagine and think differently about what the world might look like.
And how does white supremacy play a role in maintaining this myth that the police are absolutely necessary? There are people who the police do keep safe.
Certainly. And, you know, the relationship between white supremacy and the police goes all the way back. You know, as many people have noted, rightly, the police have some of their most proximate origins in slave patrols, in sort of white mobs and white vigilantes, in the kind of people, you know, who killed Ahmaud Arbery, in the Kyle Rittenhouses of the world. And between the police and sort of white vigilantes, there's always been this kind of tight relationship. But on a more fundamental level, you know, as you point to, I think quite rightly, people experience policing very, very differently. People in wealthier, well-resourced neighborhoods experience policing very differently. In fact, they don't interact with the police nearly as often as people in over-policed, hyper-policed neighborhoods in which the police enact repression and violence every day. And so the racial divide on policing is very, very real, and we see it in the consequences. We know that the police don't protect communities of color. They inflict huge amounts of violence on them. And what I try and show in the book is there's actually far more communities that are left unprotected by the police. People who are, you know, unhoused, living on the street, are subject to immense amounts of police violence. Women are not protected by the police. They're actually the objects of police violence as well. People suffering mental health crises, poor people. There are so many communities that even might believe that they're protected by the police, but when you look at the concrete facts, they really aren't.
So you write in your book, as we will see, the police don't actually help, they don't prevent violence, and they don't make any measurable contribution to public safety. If anything, what the police are most adept at is eating up billions of dollars in resources that could be repurposed to build truly secure communities. And of course, that was the sentiment captured by the idea of defund the police when Black Lives Matter, other racial justice organizations put this call out. By defund the police, they meant fund social services, fund those things that make our communities strong.
This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. The Atlanta Solidarity Fund bails out activists who are arrested for participating in social justice movements and helps them get access to lawyers. Your contribution will directly go to supporting those facing repression. Please contribute when you can. When we stand together, we are strong. Sponsored by the Atlanta Solidarity Fund. actionnetwork.org/fundraising/contribute-to-the-Atlanta-Solidarity-Fund. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. This is the school-to-prison pipeline from Wikipedia.org. In the United States, the school-to-prison pipeline, also known as school-to-prison link, school-to-prison nexus, or schoolhouse-to-jailhouse track, is the disproportionate tendency of minors and young adults from disadvantaged backgrounds to become incarcerated because of increasingly harsh school and municipal policies. Additionally, this is due to educational inequality in the U.S. Many experts have credited factors such as school disturbance laws, zero-tolerance policies and practices, and an increase in police in schools in creating the pipeline. This has become a hot topic of debate and discussion surrounding educational disciplinary policies as media coverage of youth violence and mass incarceration has grown during the early 21st century. In recent years, many have started using the term school-prison nexus in place of school-to-prison pipeline to challenge the idea of a unidirectional pipeline that begins in schools in order to show that schoolwork within the web of institutions, policies, and practices that funnel youth into prisons. Moreover, it may no longer operate as a pathway to prison, but instead a de facto prison. The current climate of mass incarceration in the U.S. increases the contact the incarceration system has with the U.S. school system. More specifically, these patterns of criminalization translate into the school context. Specific practices implemented in U.S. schools over the past 10 years to reduce violence in schools, including zero-tolerance policies and an increase in school resource officers, have created the environment for criminalization of youth in schools. This results from patterns of discipline in schools mirroring law enforcement models. The disciplinary policies and practices that create an environment of the USSPP to occur disproportionately affect disabled, Latino, and Black students, which is later reflected in the rates of incarceration between 1999 and 2007. The percentage of Black students being suspended has increased by 12%, with the percentage of white students being suspended has declined in the implementation of zero-tolerance policies. Of the total incarcerated population in the U.S., 61% are Black and Latino. Exclusionary disciplinary policies, specific zero-tolerance policies that remove students from the school environment, increase the probability of youth coming in contact with the incarceration system. Zero-tolerance policies have led to the mistreatment of students, situations, and strict disciplinary actions which create impact on students' future, causing them to go to juvenile detention centers or prison. Approximately 3.3 million suspensions, over 100,000 expulsions occur each year. This number has nearly doubled since 1974, with rates escalating in the mid-1990s as zero-tolerance policies began to widely be adopted. Rising rates of the use of expulsion and suspensions are not connected to higher rates of misbehavior. Risky behaviors is something suspended students will most likely engage in. Zero-tolerance disciplinary policies have been adopted across the country. Research is increasingly examining the connections between school failure and the later contact with the criminal justice system for minorities. Once a child drops out, they are 8 times more likely to be incarcerated than youth who graduate from high school. Studies have found that 68% of all males in state and federal prison do not have high school diplomas. Suspensions and expulsions have been shown to correlate with a young person's probability of dropping out and becoming involved in the criminal justice system. According to the American Civil Liberties Union, students suspended or expelled for a discretionary violation has nearly 3 times more likely to be in contact with the juvenile justice system the following year. However, it is unclear if the factors determining the risk of dropping out are not wholly or partially the same as the factors determining the risk of incarceration, as an individual likely to enter the criminal justice system is also likely to encounter difficulties with the education system. From 1980 to 2008, the number of people incarcerated in the U.S. quadrupled from roughly 500,000 to 2.3 million people. The graphic to the right shows the uniqueness of the practices in comparison to other countries across the globe, with the U.S. incarcerating a large portion of its population than any other country in 2008. The U.S. holds 25% of the world's prisoners, but only has 5% of the world's populations. Where there are undetected or unrelated child mental health concerns, this can lead to unwanted suspensions and expulsions. When teachers include strategies to address concerns found in the students, it leads to students wanting to pursue their own academic achievement and success. Students with diagnosable mental health problems suffer under zero-tolerance policies. Such policies aim to create safer classrooms by removing potential disruptions, but many in mental health, social services, courts, and other related fields believe they fail in the goal and may result in less safe schools and communities.
School is considered a protective factor against delinquent conduct, and removing students from such an environment harms their ability to succeed. An American Psychological Association Zero Tolerance Task Force report found that students with disabilities, especially those with emotional and behavioral disorders, appear to be suspended and expelled at rates disproportionate to the representation in the population. Zero tolerance policies also fail to account for neurological developments in youth. Studies show that the brain is still under construction until about the age of 21. Youth are more likely to take risks, act impulsively, and exercise poor judgment. When these actions result in their involvement with the criminal justice system, they are punished rather than taught how to develop. One issue in improving mental health services in schools and interrupting the SVP is that schools are unequipped to identify disorders and provide help for them. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. This comes from Guardian.com. Sadness in the whole forest. Family of cop city activist killed by police seeks answers. By Tim Pratt in Atlanta, Georgia. Manuel Paez Turan was protesting planned Atlanta Police Training Center when officers repeatedly shot and killed them. On a Thursday around noon last month, Joe Paez heard a knock on the door at his house in Chicago. Paez, who works from home managing a domestic violence intervention program, opened the door to see an officer with the Chicago Police Department. The officer asked Paez if he had a relative in Atlanta. Surprised, the Venezuelan-born social worker said, "Yes, my son." The officer took out a pad, wrote down a phone number from Georgia, ripped out the sheet of paper, and handed it to Paez. "Call this number, please," the officer said. Then he pointed to the body cam on his chest and said, "This is being recorded," and he left. Within minutes, Belkis Turan, Paez's ex-wife and mother of Manuel Paez Turan, called from Panama with the news. Police had shot and killed their son the day before on January 18th after finding the 26-year-old activist camped in a forest southeast of Atlanta, Georgia. The activist, who went by the name Tortajita, was one of the dozens trying to protect the South River Forest from a $90 million, 85-acre police and fire department training center planned for the site and, separately, a private developer's land swap. The project is known as Cop City. Officials said Tortajita fired at a Georgia State Patrol trooper first, wounding the officer. The death and the broader fight over Cop City have drawn interest from around the U.S. and all over the world. Now, Tortajita's family is demanding answers to many questions they have about the shooting and the circumstances around it, not least the lack of body cam footage. On Thursday night in Atlanta, Paez said, "They didn't use body cams when they killed my son, but they did use them when they came to inform me about killing my son." Paez was referring to what is probably the biggest obstacle facing the family and others when it comes to discovering what happened on the morning of January 18th, when dozens of officers from multiple city, county, state, and possible federal agencies swarmed the forest. There is no body cam recording of the shooting, according to the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, which took part in the sweep and is also tasked with investigating Tortajita's death. Paez Turan and Manuel's brother, Daniel, find themselves in a spotlight that comes with Tortajita becoming what experts say is the first environmental activist killed while protesting in U.S. history. Shortly after arriving from Panama last week, Manuel's mother said she hoped to help everyone who loved Manuel to heal during her stay in the city. At a press conference the family held in front of the historic courthouse in Decatur, flanked by their attorneys, Paez recounted how he would counsel Manuel to get a life and have a family, and they would agree to disagree about Manuel's involvement in projects such as defending the forest or helping to rebuild houses after Hurricane Nicole swept through Florida. "I would say, Manuel, you cannot worry about the whole world. You're not Greta Thunberg. I was wrong," the old man said. But while there is no footage of the shooting, police videos and other parts of the operation to clear the forest were released on Wednesday night. Yet, activists say the videos pose more questions for the police. There were also sections of the video appearing to show officers indicating that the wounded officer had been shot by another officer, and not Paez Turan. In one, an officer says, "Man, you fucked your own officer up." This was led by GBI and Atlanta Police Department to issue statements on Thursday asserting that the video proved nothing. Speculation on the part of an officer, as captured on the body cam, is not evidence, the GBI said. Jeff Filipovits, one of the attorneys representing the family, also issued a statement. "The videos show the clearing of the forest was a paramilitary operation that set the stage for an excessive use of force." The attorney said he had received no reply from the GBI to a letter requesting a face-to-face meeting with the family. A GBI spokesperson declined to comment on the letter. Hayes said the police videos were like having three pieces in a puzzle of 1,000 pieces. What am I going to do with these three pieces? Meanwhile, the family had spent several days getting to know the forest that Tortajita had spent months defending. Called Wilani by the activist, a Muscogee Creek name for the forest, Teron spent one afternoon visiting a southern red oak tree that Tortajita had climbed only a month before being killed, in an effort to save the tree from being knocked down in December. Several other trees with tree houses the activists built have now been felled during the sweeps and have been occurring for months. Tortajita was able to protect the red oak, known by those staying in the forest as Frog Palace, that winter day, but the tree was toppled days later. On an unusually warm afternoon this week, Teron slumped on the tree trunk, dwarfed by its size as it lays on the embankment. There's a sadness in the whole forest, Teron said, adding that she felt her son's spirit wherever she stepped. She picked up several stones, put them in her pocket, because that was something her son had done since they were a child. One night, Teron found himself in an East Atlanta Village outdoor market where native rapper Natani Means had arrived from New Mexico to perform a homage to Tortajita. For our relatives in the forest, I'm honored to be here, and a shout out to Tortajita, to his spirit in the next life, said Means, the son of Russell Means, the acclaimed native activist and actor. Once Paez, Manuel's brother Daniel, and in-laws and friends had arrived in Atlanta, the family experienced several false starts in attempting to locate where Tortajita had been camping the morning they were killed. Finally, on Tuesday, the family found the site, a gathering of several tents with food, books, and medical and other supplies on tables between them. Teron drew close to the bright red Samsonite suitcase lying open under a dark brown tarp. That's Manuel's, she said. She bent over to sort out a pile of clothes. I gave him that tie and that hat from Sweden and those shoes, she said. Members of the family came over. Paez and Daniel each touched and stared at objects belonging to Tortajita, t-shirts, boots, a shovel, a pickaxe, as if seeking answers to what had happened under the tarp. After a few moments, Paez closed the suitcase, stood it up, and beckoned the small group to gather in a circle and pray. Son, he said in Spanish, you forgot your suitcase. But you won't be needing it on the journey you're on. I'm sorry I didn't always understand you and what you were doing, but now I do. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G.
You're witnessing somebody that tunes by ear in 2017. That's impressive.
Thank you.
This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. This comes from UnicornRiot.ninja. The case of Marvin Haynes, Part 1. The first is an ongoing Unicorn Riot investigation series in the case of Marvin Haynes, who was sentenced to life in prison in 2006 at the age of 17 for a murder he says he did not commit. As of this writing, he remains in prison at Stillwater Correctional Facility. Orion Vatican, Minneapolis. The grainy surveillance camera footage shows a small interrogation room, 15 by 15, white walls, shortcut pile, dark carpet, a circular table, and a blue swivel chair. A door on the far wall stands open to the hallway and cubicles beyond. The date in the corner of the video reads 5/19/04. A counter clicks off the seconds. A bland-looking cop, a gray suit, walks in and directs a young man to the chair. The officer removes his handcuffs. The kid sits down. As the door closes, he pulls his arms into his short-sleeved shirt against the cold air conditioning. He's 16 years old, 5'7" tall, 130 pounds. He's black, and he wears a 4-inch afro, a light blue jail-issue smock, and loose pants of coarse cotton. He doesn't know yet, but in a little over a year, he'll be sentenced to spend the rest of his life in a prison cell for the murder of Randy Shearer, a white man he says he's never seen before. A jury will convict him without a shred of physical evidence linking him to the murder. The kid stares at the wall. He yawns. After a couple of minutes, he puts his head down on the laminated surface of the table. He doesn't look worried. He looks bored. 5 minutes pass, then seven. Finally, the door opens. A white man with gray hair enters the room, wearing a suit. "Hello, sir," he says. A second white cop follows him in. "How you doing?" the kid responds. I didn't get no receipt because they took my money down to what's-his-name," the kid tells him. He speaks quickly, mumbling his words, difficult to discern. "I'm sorry," the man asks. The kid repeats himself, concerned about the small amount of cash the police took from him when they booked him in jail that morning. "I'm Sergeant Keith. This is Sergeant Madsen. Your name is what?" "Marvin." "What do you go by, Marvin?" "Marvin, little Marvin," the kid responds. They shake hands. About 6 hours before the video starts, Marvin Haynes was picked up by police and told he was arrested for failure to appear in juvenile court on a previous charge. He was taken to Hennepin County Juvenile Detention Center before being transported to Room 108 in Minneapolis Police Headquarters at City Hall for interrogation. The police read Marvin his Miranda rights. They tell him he has the right to an attorney. "I want to have my mom down here," he responds. The police brush him off, asking whether his mother is a lawyer. During the interrogation, he asks for his mother at least 8 times, but the police carry on, sometimes saying they can't get a hold of her, other times ignoring him entirely. Seated across the table, the officer asks Marvin about the warrant he was picked up for. He explains he was trying to get down to court, but he couldn't make it. He says his mom tried to reschedule it for him, but her phone was turned off. His tone is casual, like he's trying to clear up a procedural matter. The officers ask Marvin where he was that weekend. He tells them he was with his cousin Boogie. He was with his girl Muffy. He was trying to get Dee Dee to braid his hair. He slept in until 3 in the afternoon on Sunday because he was out late with friends Saturday night. He yawns and leans way back in his chair, stretching as he talks. The interrogation continues. "Do you own any guns at all?" Sergeant Madsen asks. "No, I don't own no guns," Marvin replies. "We're investigating an event that happened over the flower shop off Glendale, a little bit north of Lowry. You ever been in that flower shop at all?" "Flower shop? What flower shop?" Marvin asks. "It's called Jerry's Flower Shop. You know Lowry and Lindale? They discuss the cross streets and cardinal directions." "I've never been in that flower shop," Marvin responds. "I thought you were talking about Penn, because there's like a flower shop on Penn." The police watch Marvin intently. When they bring up the flower shop, gauging his reaction, they ask him if he's seen anything in the news, and he mentions a bus accident he heard about. They prod him, asking how he gets money. "Does he have a job?" "No, I get money from girls. All kinds of girls give me money." "Why do girls give you money?" "I don't know, because I got it like that," Marvin says, with a cocky teenage smile. The cops watch him, their face stern. Did he really just brag about getting girls in the middle of a murder interrogation? Is he a skilled liar or a dumb kid who doesn't know what's going on? Fast forward 2.5 hours. Marvin is still in the room, but the scene has changed. Marvin sobbing, sits in the corner, pulling his shirt up to wipe his tears and running nose. The men are screaming and pointing at him, their face contort with the effort. They've been lying to Marvin, saying his fingerprints and DNA have been found on the murder scene. That video cameras recorded him entering and exiting the store. They tell him they're charging him with murder. "You went in there trying to look like a hardcore ass, and you didn't get what you wanted, so you turned around and you said, 'Fuck it, I'm gonna shoot this guy,'" shouts Keith. My mom's got money. I can get money anytime. I don't need to ask nobody, Marvin shouts back. The old lady wouldn't give you money, so you said, fuck it, I'm going to shoot it. Finally, Marvin swallows his tears. His voice became defiant. Okay, charge me with it then, Marvin says, and guess what? You're all going to be wrong, and I'm going to get out. The hell we are, Chief responds. They keep shouting at each other. The cop gets up and leaves the room. I got nothing to say to you. You shot the guy because you were pissed off because you didn't get your money. You got the wrong person. I got money, Marvin shouts as they leave. I ain't never did nothing, Marvin yells at the door. Y'all can't charge me with shit, the fuck. I'm only 16. Y'all better get the fuck out of here with that. The tape clicks at another 15 minutes as Marvin paces. After a while, he gets up and knocks at the door. He's been in this room for nearly 3 hours. As he paces, the cops are raiding his home where he lives with his mother and sisters. Officers are digging through his room, searching for guns, confiscating hoodies and gym pants, interrogating his mother, asking his sisters Marvina and Lakeisha when they saw Marvin that weekend. They bring in dogs to sniff the yard for evidence. They impound his mother's car, a red Ford Taurus, to the forensic yard, pending a search warrant. Meanwhile, back in interrogation room 108, Marvin eventually gets up and stands near the door. He puts his hand on the light switch and the room goes black. Marvin appears again to the room awash with fluorescent white light. Marvin's hand is still on the switch. Again, the room falls into darkness and the tape cuts to static. The scene is over. 18 minutes later, Marvin's side of the story has not changed much that day in the interrogation room, although now he tells it in the voice of a much older man from his prison cell at Stillwater Correctional Facility on the Minnesota-Wisconsin border. Marvin does not stop professing his innocence in the shooting death of Randy Shearer at Jerry's Flower Shop on May 16th. 2004. People are starting to listen. On September 2, 2005 at 6:19 p.m., 15 months after the murder of Randy Shearer, a jury unanimously found Marvin Haynes guilty of murder in first degree after only 6 hours of deliberation. Their decision relied heavily upon testimony of a handful of witnesses between the ages of 14 and 17, none of them whom had witnessed the murder, three of whom have since recanted their testimony saying they were threatened and pressured by police to lie. The only witness, flower shop cashier Cindy McDonald, initially described a man who seemed to have had an education, who was much taller and older than Marvin, a short baby-faced kid who could hardly read and had dropped out of remedial school before he was arrested. During a photo array and lineup rife with procedural violations, McDermott first identified another kid as the shooter before settling on Haynes. The murder investigation was led by Sergeant Mike Keith and David Watson of the Minneapolis Police Department. Sergeant Keith, who was promoted to lieutenant 3 years later before being demoted again, had a long documented history riddled with accusations of inappropriate, racist, and unprofessional behavior in his role as a law enforcement officer. The 2020 report investigating the high-profile wrong conviction of Myron Burrell in Minneapolis accused Keith of tunnel vision and confirmation bias, explained as a disinclination to seek evidence that can disconfirm one's belief. Nothing less, in late September 2005, Marvin Haynes was sentenced to life in prison at the age of 17. Haynes' public defender unsuccessfully appealed some of the aspects of his trial to the Minnesota Supreme Court, which has jurisdiction over all appeals in first-degree murder cases. The court affirmed his conviction, issuing a 13-page opinion disagreeing with Haynes' attorney about the procedural issues they objected to. Over 18 years have passed since Haynes was initially arrested, every day of which he spends in state custody. The case of Marvin Haynes stands as a historical precursor to the events of 2020 in Minneapolis, from the murder of George Floyd to the burning of the Third Precinct, which laid bare the city's violent and racist foundations. In April 2022, a damning report by the Minnesota Department of Human Rights officially stated that the city overpoliced and a heavily incarcerated underclass had been saying for decades Minneapolis cops are a racist, violent paramilitary force that routinely act outside the law with impunity. In late 2020, the Great North Innocence Project agreed to review Haynes' case in early January of this year. They issued a report to Minnesota Conviction Review Unit calling for Haynes to be fully exonerated. Marvin Haynes is innocent of the crime for which he was convicted, wrote Innocence Project attorney Andrew Marquardt. In the report, the interest of injustice demands that he should be fully exonerated and released from the prison as soon as possible. Conviction Review Unit, known as CRU, was formed in 2021 with a partnership between Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison's office and the Great North Innocence Project. It is one of 96 such conviction review units currently operating in the country, but one of only four that are run by the state's Attorney General's office. The CRU was formed in the wake of Myron Burrell case, which brought national attention to wrongful convictions, juvenile life sentences, and racial bias among police, judges, and juries in Minneapolis. Haynes was arrested just 2 years after Burrell amid the same era of tough-on-crime panic and the two cases that bear many similarities. The Innocence Project is calling for the CRU to consider Haynes' case. If the CRU decides to intervene, they will make a recommendation to the Minnesota Attorney General, Keith Ellison, who makes the final decision in the CRU process. However, since Haynes was convicted by a Hennepin County Attorney's Office, newly elected Progressive Prosecutor Mary Moriarty will be involved in the process and could, if she chooses, decide to vacate Haynes' conviction with or without the CRU process. After decades of service as a public defender, the Haynes case may be one of the first opportunities for voters to test Moriarty on her progressive platform as a prosecutor. Unicorn Riot conducted interviews and reviewed thousands of pages of court documents, trial transcripts, and police reports in the course of our investigation into Haynes' case. Those documents and conversations revealed a pattern of police coercing, teenage witness, and investigation completely lacking physical evidence linking Haynes to the scene, repeated violations of police eyewitness identification procedures, and an overall pattern of racial bias. In the midst of our investigation, the state's key witness, Marvin's younger cousin, Isaiah Harper, admitted to lying about Marvin's guilt at trial. Harper, who was only 14 at the time of the murder, told Unicorn Riot that cops got him to say what they wanted him to say by threatening him for decades behind bars. They continued to coerce his testimony despite him telling judges and juries repeatedly that he was lying and that police had made the story up. In this series, we'll walk you through the case of Marvin Haynes, from the murder of Brandy Shearer at Jerry's Flower Shop in Minneapolis North Side to the ensuing investigation and trial. Along the way, we'll talk witnesses, family members, community activists, ex-cops, and politicians about the case and the broader context in which it unfolded. The tough-on-crime era that packed the nation's prisons with disproportionately numbers of black and brown people and the ruthless reign of Amy Klobuchar as Hennepin County Attorney. This is the first article of an ongoing investigation looking at the case of Marvin Haynes. Stay tuned to our next article. We'll take a close look at the murder of Brandy Shearer and the context of the economic abandonment of Minneapolis North Side in which it occurred. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. The Atlanta Solidarity Fund bails out activists who are arrested for participating in social justice movements and helps them get access to lawyers. Your contribution will directly go to supporting those facing repression. Please contribute when you can. When we stand together, we are strong. Sponsored by the Atlanta Solidarity Fund. actionnetwork.org/fundraising/contribute-to-the-Atlanta-Solidarity-Fund. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. This is from the KansasReflector.com. Known to be toxic for a century, lead still poisons thousands of Midwestern kids. Researchers say even a small amount of toxin can harm kids' development. One 2021 study found Iowa, Kansas, Nebraska, and Missouri had some of the highest rates of elevated blood level in children. This is by Allison Kite and Niara Savage, Clarkson Valley, Missouri. April 11th, 2022. When the pediatrician recommended Lisa Pasco have her son and toddler tested for lead poisoning, she thought there was no way he could be at risk. Everything in her South St. Louis home had been remodeled. But then the nurse called to say blood lead level was dangerously high, five times the level federal health officials then deemed elevated. Pasco said she was completely shocked. After you hang up the phone, you kind of go through a process of, oh my gosh, my kid is lead poisoned. What does that mean? What do I do? The same week, St. Louis City health workers came out to test the home to identify the source of lead. The culprit, the paint on the home's front window, friction caused by opening and closing the window, caused lead dust to collect in the mulch and soil outside of the house, right where her son played every day. A decade later, the physiological scars remain. Pascal and her toddler ended up leaving their St. Louis home to escape lead hazards. To this day, she's extra cautious about making sure her son, now a preteen, and her two-year-old daughter aren't exposed to lead so she doesn't have to relive the nightmare. Pasco's son was one of almost 4,700 Missouri children with dangerous levels of lead in their blood in the state's 2012 report. Decades after the U.S. started phasing lead out of gasoline and banned it in new residential paint and water pipes, Missouri's lead poisoning reports run from July through June. Though cases have fallen precipitously since the mid-20th century, lead is persistent poison that impacts thousands of families each year, particularly low-income communities and families of color. Eradicating it has been a decade-long battle. No safe level. Omaha, Nebraska has been cleaning up contaminated soil from two smelters for more than 20 years. The Argentine neighborhood of what is now Kansas City, Kansas, grew up around a smelter that produced tens of thousands of tons of lead as well as silver and zinc. About 60% of the homes in Iowa were built before 1960 when residential lead-based paint was still used. Missouri is the number one producer of lead in the United States.
Well, we have a surprise for you guys, because these next two songs, these friends for you guys, are going to be new stuff you haven't heard yet. It does not exist only on this live show, maybe others to come. See, you guys are one of the first people to hear this before. But this album we are currently working on, this first one is called Madness.
Yeah. All right.
Madness.
Lead still poisons thousands of Midwestern kids. The four states have some of the most lead water pipes per capita in the country. While representative data of the prevalence of lead poisoning is hard to come by because screening rates lag in many areas, one study published last year found that the four states struggle with some of the highest rates of lead poisoning. Over the next few months, the Missouri Independent NPR Midwest Newsroom are collaborating to investigate high levels of lead in children in Iowa, Kansas, Missouri, and Nebraska. By analyzing scientific research, delving into the state and local data, and interviewing parents, experts, and advocates from across the country, the project will shed light on a public health disaster that continues to poison children every year. We know there is no safe level, that even at really low levels, it can affect intellectual growth, cognitive development, and we can prevent that type of harm, said Elizabeth Friedman, a physician and director of the Pediatric Environmental Health Specialty Unit in Kansas, Missouri, Nebraska, and Iowa. So why shouldn't we? David Swinty, director of the Center for Health Effects of Environmental Contamination at the University of Iowa, said it's unacceptable for anyone to be exposed to lead. We should go to the ends of the earth to invest in staff and preventing from happening if we can, Swinty says. In predominantly black neighborhoods in North St. Louis and across from Pascal's old home, children suffer some of the highest rates of lead poisoning in the city. Black children in Missouri are nearly twice as likely to suffer lead poisoning as their white peers. And this happens because of the racist historical practices and policies that continue to segregate children and families of color into older, sometimes less maintained, overburdened, and under-resourced neighborhoods where lead exposure are more common, Friedman said. Philip Blandergan, a lead researcher for 50 years, did research and testing near the enormous smelter in Kellogg, Idaho in the early 1970s. And the doctor who was the doctor for the lead company told me one time in a meeting that the only kids in Kellogg, Idaho who got lead poisoning are the dumb and the dirty, Langer said. And even though that was 50 years ago, that line of thinking is still alive and well. Being interviewed for a book, the author asked him about his own family. He says, "You do this for a living, right?" I said, "Do you have kids?" "Yes." "Can you protect your own children?" "Absolutely not." Unled is a joint investigation by the Missouri Independent and the Midwest Newsroom exploring the issue of high levels of lead in children in Iowa, Kansas, Missouri, and Nebraska. This is the Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G.
So zinc is a transition metal, but it's a little bit odd because zinc always has a charge of 2 plus. Sulfur, that's 2 minus. So these charges, they need to add up to 0 to have a net charge of 0 for this neutral zinc sulfide molecule. So 2 plus and 2 minus, that adds up to 0. So this is the formula for zinc sulfide, ZnS. Let's remove the charges to clean it up a little bit. And there you have it, the formula for zinc sulfide, ZnS. Dr. B, and thanks for watching.
You've been keeping track of what the CIA and the Defense Department have been doing for a long time as far as using us as guinea pigs for mind control and other types of horrible things they have in mind for us and the rest of the people in the world. What are some of them?
Well, it started out basically with the CIA doing experimentations on their own men to discover if they could get rid of agents who were going to quit the department and still had classified information. So they utilized different types of drugs and pain and hypnosis and electric shock to try and get the guys to forget. Then they also did experimentations to using different chemicals to see if you can induce a person to commit a crime or induce him to do that or to do this. Of course, the CIA claimed that it didn't carry it through. The documentation we got was actually that they did that. Then we came across the overall project called MKUltra. Its earlier code name was Artichoke, and that included 149 sub-projects. And those sub-projects range from what I just described to open-air testing in the United States, experimentation on prisoners, experimentation on soldiers, experimentation on college students.
Would these people know they were being experimented on and gave their approval?
No, except for the quote-unquote volunteer. The way the volunteer army program worked is it started in 1959, and the guys were just told that they would be doing experimentation on new weapons. And then they get to Fort Detrick, Maryland, where the experimentation was done, and find out that they were going to be doing it on drugs and chemicals. The major thing that they used after that was zinc cadmium sulfide, which the army spokesman has again said is harmless. But the only scientific studies that we've come up with is says that it could be very harmful. In fact, if a person is exposed to it continuously, it could cause death. But it would definitely cause anyone with respiratory problems to get it agitated to a degree that they would either get very, very sick or they could actually die.
Well, they've used Texas and Texans as guinea pigs for a long time, haven't they?
Yes, and that's zinc, cadmium, sulfide. Now, that was done at what we've documented in at least 15 different locations in the U.S., one of which was in Dallas in 1961. A series of 34 different tests were done off a TV tower where they blew it out to a very large area, and the whole test area went from Dallas all the way down to Killeen, Texas, which is a long way. It's like 160 miles.
Well, Austin's been involved in one of these tests, too, hasn't he?
Right. The other series of tests that we discovered with zinc cadmium sulfide was in the test area was described as from Corpus Christi up to San Antonio, Austin, and over to Houston. So it was that area. And they sprayed off jet bombers zinc cadmium sulfide by following the coastline, and then it would blow in to the coast. And then they set up samplers to see the concentration and how far it would go in. That was done in 1965 in that area. Then a year later, they did a similar type test, but this time the simulant used was 23 tons of glass beads and cork particles.
Glass beads and cork particles, and we inhale these?
Yeah. Now, those wouldn't be as dangerous as zinc cadmium sulfide, but I don't think I'd want to breathe 23 tons of glass beads.
No.
So, and again, the thing is, now, with these tests, we are currently trying to get Texas senators at least. We've given a submission to Senator Tower and Benson, and to ask them to please put a ban on any chemical biological warfare testing without anyone's permission. So that if a city wants to, you know, be utilized as a guinea pig, then they have the ability to say whether they want it or not. I mean, it's just not okay for Dallas to get sprayed and everyone in the city get that effect without their permission. And so we are trying currently to get a ban on this.
What about the certain types of testing of strictly racial or ethnic nature?
Well, we discovered that actually what they're phrased as is ethnic weapons. Now, in the United States, we've been able to document that Negro men were experimented on with LSD and other hallucinogenics who were either mental patients or prisoners. And the attempt with that is to discover how different ethnic groups or races would not be as immune to something as someone else, like as with Soviet Russia, they don't have yellow fever. So those guys hadn't built up an immunity to yellow fever yet. So if you used a particular chemical in that area, then, say, Russians may not have that immunity and might get an epidemic real quick and then disable the country immediately.
That reminds me back in the old days, the good old days, when the Army and all used to give the smallpox-infected blankets to the Indians.
Right.
We haven't really changed much, have we? Except we've gone on a mass-produced basis and have the ability to spread it throughout the whole world.
Well, the irresponsibility with it is what is a terrible thing, because the Army apparently felt like some of the guys are good guys, and they really probably felt that we need to do chemical biological warfare tests to make sure we don't get attacked on it. I mean, what if Russia came over here and did a, you know, sprayed a chemical in the United States? What would happen? But who was responsible for telling the Army that that chemical was safe? I mean, that has never been in any of the documentation. Who was responsible for saying that BZ, which is an extremely dangerous drug, could be used on our soldiers? Who said it was okay to use Agent Orange and that it was harmless? You know, those guys cannot be found. They're not in the documentation. You can find out about all the tests, and then, of course, you go to the Army because the Army conducted the test. But who in the Army said it was okay? And that's what I think is the thing that must be found out, because those individuals, I think, should be prosecuted. It was a criminal thing and shouldn't have been done.
Yeah! our country today, income inequality is getting worse and worse. Something's wrong, and people know it. Billionaire brothers Charles and David Koch are the poster boys for the top 1%. Yeah, made by their father Filthy Fred, who made his fortune in the oil business in the Soviet Union of the 1930s. Stalin himself brought Filthy Fred Koch into the Soviet Union to build oil refineries and teach them how to be oil engineers. Filthy Fred Koch wrote screeds against the civil rights movement, saying that it was communist-driven and that white children should not go to school with black children. He said it would lead to the mongrelization of the races. This is the climate that the two brothers, Charlie and David, grew up in. And then they inherited a big pile of money from Daddy Filthy Fred. Then they put that into their own organization and helped build it up to where it is now. An enterprise that, so far, has put over $100 billion in the two Koch boys' pockets. Koch Industries is the second largest privately held corporation in the country. They have holdings that range from oil and gas to paper products, forestry, consumer goods, plastics, and ranching to run roughshod over the American people. Koch Industries is filthy, filthy, filthy. One of the top 15 filthy.
A media operation. Controlled by two corporations, they deregulated by the FCC.
You mean Disney, Fox, Westinghouse, and good old GE?
They own networks from CBS to CNBC.
They can use them to say whatever they please and work down the opinions of anyone who disagrees.
Or shout about PCBs.
What are PCBs?
They come from electric power plants built by Westinghouse and GE.
They can give you lots of cancer that can hurt your body.
But on network TV, you rarely hear anything bad about the nuclear industry.
Like when Westinghouse was sued for fraud?
Which time?
GE made defective bolts. It was an unreported crime. Or when it was boycotted for operating nuclear bomb plants just to squeeze a dime.
That's a footnote, by the way.
A footnote protects you from folks who doubt what you say. Now maybe the voices in my head will go away.
But the big shots don't care. They're all sitting pretty thanks to corporate welfare.
What's that now?
They get billions in subsidies from the government. It's supposed to create jobs, but that's not how it's spent. They use tax and soft money to support congressmen who will own the weapons programs again and again. And let them dump toxic waste where the young ones play.
GE made the bullets that shot JFK. They can use them to say whatever they please and work down the opinions of anyone who disagrees.
Or shout about PCBs.
What are PCBs?
They come from electric power plants built by Westinghouse and GE.
They can give you lots of cancer that can hurt your body.
They own networks from CBS to CNBC. A media operation. A media operation. A media operation. A media operation. All media controlled by
when you step out of line, athwart the line of mainstream discourse, for want of a better word, in the American press, mainstream, if you cross a certain line, you get done. We've actually seen a couple of cases this summer in the form of Mike Gallagher, who wrote an incredible series of pieces in the Cincinnati Enquirer about Chiquita Banana, previously known as United Fruit Company. One of the best series, actually, on a multinational corporation that's ever appeared in mainstream American journalism, or even on the left. It was a brilliant, brilliant portrait, for which assiduousness and tenacity, he was immediately fired and run out of the profession, fired under the accusation that he'd got telephone conversations, to which the answer is, he says he got them from a source, but so what? And Gary Webb's case, his colleagues turned on him, including his own editor and his own colleague, just as they're making news. You like solidarity in your business, don't be a journalist, at least in the mainstream. And then, of course, we saw this summer the case of April Oliver and Jack Smith, who did a piece for CNN on use of sarin in Love, for which documentary, actually they did an hour and it was cut to 18 minutes, and then they were accused of missing things out. They were, of course, fired and kicked out. So you've had all these cautionary tales. Cautionary tales where there are certain areas you can't approach in American journalism without getting into deep trouble. One is assassination. You start saying the CIA actually abused assassination as a national policy for many years. You get into trouble. You get into trouble if you start kicking too deeply into the drugs business. And of course, you get into trouble if you start saying that major American corporations are focused on thievery and exploitation on an unlawful international scale, and appear to have conversations to prove it. As we used to say when I started journalism, comment is free and facts are expensive.
William Lutz, what is doublespeak?
Doublespeak is language designed to evade responsibility, make the unpleasant appear pleasant, the unattractive appear attractive. Basically, it's language that pretends to communicate, but really doesn't. It is language designed to mislead. Doublespeak is not a slip of the tongue or a mistaken use of language. It's exactly the opposite. It is language used by people who are very intelligent, very sophisticated in the use of language, and know that it can do an awful lot with language. If we count government from the local level all the way up to the federal level, I had to stop writing the chapter on government doublespeak. It was going to take over the whole book. But interestingly enough, and this was a revelation in doing the book, about a half a step behind comes business with a tremendous amount of doublespeak. I think of government as the third oldest profession, and probably from the moment government was instituted, doublespeak came with it. I cite examples from the 5th century BC in Greece, Julius Caesar, when he pacified Gaul. Of course, Nazi Germany thrived on doublespeak, so it's been around for quite a while. In 1978, I became head of the Committee on Public Doublespeak, and in 1980, I started editing the Quarterly Review of Doublespeak, and that's when I became very interested in it, simply because as editing, I have all the examples of doublespeak sent to me, so I wade through them all. I did, in my PhD, I did work in rhetoric, and I was interested in rhetoric, and in 1977, I published a textbook called The Age of Communication, which was a little different at the time. I tried to examine the rhetoric of television, radio, the mass media, advertising, taking Aristotle's classical rhetoric and apply it to modern media. I had a lot of fun doing that, and as a result of that textbook, I was asked to join the committee, and I saw rhetoric and language coming all together in doublespeak in an interesting way. They did a series of articles in the Philadelphia Inquirer on the tax reform bill showing that through false, deceptive language that was inserted into the bill, billions of dollars in special tax breaks were given away to individuals and companies and corporations. And it was all done through deceptive language that no one knew understood the language. It was written in such a way that it applied only to one individual. Great example. One business was defined as a family farm in that bill, thereby giving them the special tax breaks for farmers. That business employs 25,000 people and has a gross income of over $1.5 billion a year. The tax bill called them a family farm. The Committee on Public Doublespeak of the National Council of Teachers of English, we take nominations from anybody who wants to give us nominations. We vote. We have 35 members on the committee. They're all teachers of English. We have one statistician and one philosopher on the committee, and we vote. What we look for is someone who has contributed to clarity in language and public discourse. Nightline, I think, is a good example. Ted Koppel, I think, is famous for saying, wait a minute here, can we back up and explain that one for a minute? I mean, he's very good at doing that, and we think that that contributes to clarity in discourse. We gave it to Bartlett and Steele because of revealing that intricacies of that tax law were needlessly done, and that the language was deliberately opaque to give special tax breaks to a lot of people and corporations, that tens of billions of dollars worth. We think that that's important, that people know about that, that this language is being used to take money out of their pocket, because somebody's going to have to make up for that missing tax revenue. So we're looking for people who contribute to honesty in language, clarity in language that way. And from the nominations that we receive, and we try to give the award to as a symbolic award to an American public figure who has used doublespeak that has consequences of some kind on public policy or a public issue. In 1989, we gave it to Exxon Corporation for calling the 35 miles of shoreline in Alaska environmentally clean. When reporters pointed out that there was still oil all over the place, an Exxon spokesman said, well, clean doesn't mean that every oil stain is off every rock. It means the natural inhabitants can live there.
Let me go quickly through the list through the 80s. 80 was Ronald Reagan. 81 was Alexander Haig. 82 was the Republican National Committee. 83, Ronald Reagan. 84, the Department of State. 85, the CIA. 86, NASA. 87, Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North. And 88, Defense Secretary Frank Carlucci, Admiral William Crowe, and Rear Admiral William Fogarty. A political question to you. If someone read that list, they would think possibly that this is a one-sided award to only one side of the political spectrum.
Well, for this reason, the Republican Party has been in power for 8 years. And so, when Jimmy Carter was in, he got it. so, you know, these are the people who have the power to affect public policy through their language. As I point out, Democrats don't get quoted too much these days. They're not in power. If they get in power, they'll be right in there in the list with everybody else. I don't see it. I mean, we cited Dukakis during his campaign for his doublespeak, which he used. And if he had been elected president, he'd be in the running along with everyone else. No, they both used it. It seems to go with the territory. Our point is that, as Orwell said, it's political language, and political language tends to, in the 20th century, to be this kind of misleading and deceptive language, whether it's Johnson. By the way, the legacy from the Johnson administration was the language of Vietnam and the language of the poverty program, which stopped calling people poor and started calling them disadvantaged and stopped talking about slums and ghettos, but the inner city. That's a heritage of doublespeak from the Johnson administration. I cite a couple incidents in the book where I can document it was done. One is revenue enhancement. They had a meeting in the Office of Management and Budget. They said, we need a phrase to replace tax increase. They came up with revenue enhancement. When Lawrence Kudlow, the economist, was asked why they did that, he said, because there's no better way to sell economic policy than the euphemistic route. He was quite proud of the fact that they came up with that phrase. And Peacekeeper, as the name for the MX missile. Again, Robert McFarlane chaired the committee meeting in which he facetiously suggested that they couldn't name it Widowmaker, could they? So instead they came up with Peacemaker. But later, President Reagan misread his cue cards and said Peacekeeper. And since it was a televised speech, it became the Peacekeeper. And it was a name that was deliberately designed to make a nuclear missile sound nice. They will hear some of it, but not all of it. One of my favorite examples from this past year is the Resource Development Park that they were going to establish in Kansas City, until the good folks in the neighborhood where they were going to put the park asked, what is a Resource Development Park? Do you know what a Resource Development Park is? In Kansas City, it's a dump. They were going to put a dump in their neighborhood until somebody asked what it meant. They deliberately invented that phrase to try and slip a dump into the neighborhood without anyone noticing it until it was too late. You can just subscribe to that. In fact, most of the subscribers are civilian public and not even English teachers. It's $8 a year. It's subsidized by the National Council of Teachers of English. So that's why the cost is so low. You can simply write to the Quarterly Review of Doublespeak in Urbana, Illinois.
I've got the 1111 yep. Kenyon Road, Urbana, Illinois.
Yes.
61801, National Council of Teachers of English. And $8 and you're a subscriber.
And you're a subscriber.
And what will you get out of this?
I edit it. You will get all the latest examples of doublespeak that are sent to me, which I put in there. Articles on doublespeak, book reviews on books of interest, cartoons, short pieces on what's the latest in advertising doublespeak. And I try to make it fun and funny and interesting and entertaining at the same time. You also learn things like how to read public opinion polls so that you're not misled by the results.
I'm gonna make you mine. Long story short, I went ahead and made a documentary which investigated the rumor that there was more than just an implicit link between the success of abstract expressionism in Europe, and indeed domestically, and American foreign policy objectives during the Cold War. That's how I got into the story. Good part of, you know, 1.5 to 2 years in archives in Abilene, Kansas, and your National Archives here, and just about everywhere else in the States, I realized that I had a much bigger story than I had anticipated. In the spring of 1966, the British poet Stephen Spender wrote a letter to Julius Fleischmann, patron of the Congress for Cultural Freedom and president of the Farfield Foundation. These two bodies were the publisher and financial arm, respectively, of Encounter magazine, of which Spender was co-editor. Both billed themselves as privately funded, independent organizations committed to promoting intellectual and artistic freedom. But rumors had been circulating at every literary cocktail party in London, Paris, and New York that they were not quite as free as they appeared, and Spender now wanted urgent clarification. Was it true, he asked Fleischmann, that the Congress and the Farfield Foundation were financially beholden to the American government? The allegation, he continued plaintively, was putting him in a terrible position as the editor of a magazine which emphasized its independence. After a delay of several months, during which time Spender's letter was passed from hand to hand in Washington, Spender received the reply he was hoping for. There was absolutely no truth to the rumors. Both the Congress for Cultural Freedom and the Farfield Foundation, in Fleischmann's words, had never accepted any funds from any government agency. Less than a year later, the hollowness of this denial was established. Fleischmann, heir to a vast gin and yeast fortune, was awash with money and had acquired the sobriquet, the Maecenas of American culture, for his abundant largesse towards the Congress for Cultural Freedom and its multitude of offshoots. But he was also legendary for his personal meanness, the stingiest rich man I had ever known, according to one contemporary. Spender, too, had first-hand acquaintance of Fleischmann's parsimony. When his wife had borrowed a dime from Fleischmann to make a telephone call in a restaurant where they were dining, she had been urged, in all seriousness, to repay it. Junkie, as he was known, didn't forget his debt. The dime was certainly Junkie's, but the money he had been dispensing with such public generosity since the early 1950s was not. It was the CIA's. Fleischmann was simply a conduit, part of the famous pipeline that was pumping money to the Congress for Cultural Freedom and a reservoir of other organizations which served the U.S. government in its covert battle for ideological supremacy in the Cold War. While Spender appeared content to broadcast the denial he had received from Fleischmann, others were less acquiescent. By early 1966, the California-based Ramparts magazine had already sent out journalists to truffle around in the undergrowth of the Internal Revenue Service, where the tax returns of philanthropic foundations revealed some bizarre discrepancies. There was the Hoblitzel Foundation, whose primary purpose is listed in the Directory of American Foundations as providing support to organizations within Texas, primarily in Dallas, with emphasis on aid for the handicapped. So why on earth was it funding the Italian magazine Tempo Presente, a publication of the Congress for Cultural Freedom? And what possible interest could the Miami District Fund have in the German magazine Der Monat, also published by the Congress? Ramparts was closing in on the CIA's crown jewels. For hiding behind frontmen like Julius Fleischmann and dummy foundations like the Farfield, the CIA had, from its inception in 1947, alighted upon culture as one of the central theaters of the Cold War. It was the secret Maecenas, the crypto patron behind thousands of books, literally, books in which it was wholly or partially involved, and scores of magazines, congresses and concerts, art exhibitions and seminars. As the Cold War froze and ideologies divided, the CIA was in effect acting as America's hidden Ministry of Culture. The centerpiece of the CIA's Kulturkampf, or cultural struggle, was the Congress for Cultural Freedom. Established in Berlin in the summer of 1950, the Congress was an apparently spontaneous alliance of intellectuals and artists committed to demonstrating the fallibility of the Soviet mythos and the superiority of Western democracy as a framework for cultural and philosophical inquiry. Its membership read like a who's who of the éminences of the period: Julian Huxley, Mertje Eliade, André Malraux, Guido Piovene, Herbert Reed, Thornton Wilder, J.P. Narayan, Hugh Trevor Roper, James T. Farrell, Raymond Aron, Igor Stravinsky, Ignazio Silone, Roberto Rossellini, Willy Brandt, Ernst Reuter, A.J. Eyre, Herbert Reed, Malcolm Muggeridge, James Burnham, Sidney Hook, Arthur Schlesinger Jr., Arthur Koestler, Mary McCarthy, Diana and Lionel Trilling, Norman Thomas, Upton Sinclair, John Steinbeck, Alan Tate, Robert Penn Warren. The list is endless. It is endless. I just realized it goes on and on. It even featured Jackson Pollock, though he was probably drunk when he joined. Honorary presidents were Bertrand Russell, Benedetto Croce, John Dewey, Carl Jaspers, Salvador de Madariaga. Articles appeared in the New York Times, exposing a wide range of covert action undertaken by the dark angels of American government. The suggestion that many intellectuals had been animated by the dictates of American policymakers rather than by independent standards of their own generated widespread disgust. The moral authority enjoyed by the intelligentsia during the height of the Cold War was now seriously undermined and frequently mobbed. The consensocracy was falling apart. The center could not hold. And as it disintegrated, so the story itself became fragmented, partial, modified, sometimes egregiously, by forces on the right and indeed on the left, who wished to twist its peculiar truths to their own ends. Ironically, the circumstances, therefore, which made possible the revelations contributed to their real significance becoming obscured. As America's anti-communist campaign in Vietnam brought us to the brink of social collapse, and with subsequent scandals on the scale of the Pentagon Papers and Watergate, it was hard to sustain interest or outrage in the business of Kulturkampf, which in comparison seemed to be fluff on the side. History, wrote Archibald MacLeish, is like a badly constructed concert hall with dead spots where the music can't be heard. What I've attempted to do in this book is to record those dead spots. It seems to me that it's the duty of historians to seek a different acoustic, to look for a tune other than that played by the official virtuosi of the period. Gore Vidal, that wonderful charlatan, has described recent American history as a phenomenon where the agreed-upon facts are not as numerous as professional historians like to think, obliging them to fictionalize anew those official fictions that have been agreed upon by altogether too many too interested parties, each with his own thousand days in which to set up his own misleading pyramids and obelisks that purport to tell some time. Let's not settle for the agreed-upon facts, then, but rather challenge them.
Manuel Cortadita was killed, shot over 12 times, shot so many times we can't even say exactly how many times he was shot. It was death by firing squad. It was a murder. We feel that Andre Dickens has blood on his hands. Governor Kemp has blood on his hands.
That's right.
The Atlanta Police Department has blood on their hands.
That's right.
The troopers who shot there have blood on their hands. We find it incredibly, not even difficult to believe, impossible to believe, that the Atlanta Police Department, the DeKalb Police Department, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, state troopers, SWAT troopers, some even say FBI were in there, that no one had a body cam on. No one had any imagery whatsoever of the killing of this young person. That means it was a setup. The Atlanta Police Department is required to have their body cams on. But yet they forgot doing a killing spree or doing a shooting of 13, 14 bullets. It is impossible to believe the narrative of the police, not just in this case, but in case after case across the country, what brought people out into the forest, into the streets, to demonstrate against Cop City has been the police murder over and over and over again across this country of black and brown people in particular. What brought people out into the streets has been the lies told by the police in their reports about how these killings took place, only to find out later that they were lying. Only to find out later there was videotape, there was body cameras, there were people filming on their phones that showed that they were lying. These demonstrations, since the very beginning, were criminalized by the Atlanta Police Department and by the mayor's office. Since the very beginning, there were arrests made by people walking and doing what you would call peaceful protests in the streets, demonstrating on sidewalks. Those protests broken up, over 17, 18 people arrested. No one reports it as violence by the police. Protesters thrown on the ground, pepper sprayed, harassed. It was the logical conclusion that they would wind up killing somebody because the tactics that they employed since the very beginning have been violent against protesters. We know that Cop City, is this a place where they're going to train not only Georgia police officers, but officers around the country? 43% are going to be trained, or the training happening is going to be of officers from outside of Georgia. They don't call those folks outside agitators. Those folks are coming here to learn training that is militarized by its very nature, that is meant to not only over-police black and brown communities in the United States, but it's also meant to shut down protests and movements against police violence. That is the very nature of what this is. They want to shut down movements in this country against police violence. So when we talk about Cop City, we're not talking about some benign training center where the cops are going to learn training. The cop that killed Rayshard Brooks had over 2,000 hours. 2,000 hours of training on sensitive, on cultural sensitivity, on de-escalation, but yet he shot him in the back. My assumption is these cops in the woods had thousands of hours of training. But yet over a dozen bullets took this young person's life. So we know that this Cop City idea is nothing but a way to militarize police here in Atlanta and across the country. And every time they bring up the idea of Cop City, there's going to be protesters, there's going to be organizing, there's going to be agitators, there's going to be forest defenders. Because we will do what we can to protect our communities, to stop Cop City from happening. Thank you very much.